I'm Rachel Otwell for Illinois Edition. A crowd of about 1,000 people gathered in Springfield at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum last Friday. They were there to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson speak.
Is there anybody left in the town out there? What? Isn't like school still in session? Do people have jobs? What? I'm honored. Whatever is not otherwise happening in this town, thank you for being here.
The well-known astrophysicist directs the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He also hosted Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. The television show appeared on Fox and won 4 Emmy Awards. Tyson spoke with reporters before he gave a speech while picking up the Lincoln Leadership Prize. He expounded on recent comments he had made, saying dysfunctional political leaders are a result of a dysfunctional electorate.
Look how much energy we spend complaining about who our leaders are. And no time do we spend complaining about ourselves who are doing the voting. So that's why you don't see me beating elected leaders over the head. It's because somebody put them in office. So as an educator, to protect our democracy, what you need is as informed a public as you possibly can generate. That would be the task of the educators and the school systems and school boards. And when you do this, then you can have some hope that when people vote, when people pass legislation, especially in the 21st century where so much depends on your understanding of the science with regard to energy and climate and transportation and housing and food and all of these major sectors of our society, in the future will require insights and innovations in STEM fields. So this is where literacy in those fields matters. So as an educator, I think we need as informed an electorate as possible, lest we unravel this thing we call a democracy.
That was Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking to reporters in Springfield. He also addressed a crowd of students and fans. Here's part of that talk.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm an astrophysicist. All I do is just share my love of the universe with whoever will listen. And apparently, it's become a lot of people lately. So I'm shocked and astonished every time I wake up and realize that, which is an awesome responsibility, actually, because the message is about science. It's not about me. It's not about any one person. It's about something that transcends us all. It's about science and what role it may play in saving us from ourselves, preserving civilization as we've come to know and love it. What I'd like to do is read a speech I wrote. Normally I don't read anything, I just talk. But this speech I was invited to write by the Abraham Lincoln Museum and Library Foundation to reflect on the Gettysburg Address, 1863. So I was asked to do this. They called me up. I don't know any more, at the time, I didn't know any more about Lincoln than anybody else. And I'm a scientist. I said, why are you calling me? Well, no, we want you to, do you know how many words are in the Gettysburg Address? I said, no, they said 272. I said, you counted that? What? What? I mean, what's impressive is how short the speech is, of course. So I was asked, can I write a 272-word speech that reflected whatever Lincoln meant to me? And I was pretty sure Lincoln didn't mean anything different to me than he did to any other American. So I didn't think myself worthy of participating in such a volume. They were going to compile these into a book. But I said, I'll get back to you. So I slept on it over the weekend. I said, wait a minute, I have a memory of something. Didn't Abraham Lincoln charter the National Academy of Sciences? I looked it up. Yeah, I had a memory of that. And I had other memories, too. Yes, that he instituted the land-grant college system, democratizing higher education, laying the seeds, literal and figurative seeds, for modern agriculture. But this is the guy with slavery and freedom. No, he's more than that. Understandably, we think of him primarily as presiding over the Civil War. I get that. But he's so much more than that. And so I wrote my version of the Gettysburg Address as requested by the Abraham Lincoln Library Foundation. So I'm going to read it to you. Afterwards, I will just open the mic for questions from you. Because this is my first time in Springfield, and I'm pretty sure everyone who lives in Springfield is in this room right now. So I'd be delighted to hear questions you have about life, the universe, and everything. By the way, there's about 7,000 to 8,000 astrophysicists in the world, and about 7 to 8 billion people. If you divide those two numbers, astrophysicists are one in a million. So if you were ever in the same room as an astrophysicist ever, that's when you gotta ask your questions, okay? So please indulge me as I read for you. This is on the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. And I titled it Seedbed. 1.5 centuries ago, civil war divided these United States of America. Yet in its wake, we would anneal as one nation indivisible. During the bloody year of the Gettysburg Address, President Lincoln chartered the National Academy of Sciences, comprised of 50 distinguished American researchers, whose task was then, as now, to advise Congress and the executive branch of all the ways the frontier of science may contribute to the health, the wealth, and security of its residents. As a young nation, just 67 years old, we had plucked the engineering fruits of the Industrial Revolution that had transformed Europe. But Americans had yet to embrace the meaning of science to society. Now, with more than 2,000 members, the National Academy encompasses dozens of fields undreamt of at the time of Lincoln's charter. Quantum physics, discovered in the 1920s, now drives nearly 1/3 of the world's wealth, forming the basis for our computer revolution in the creation, storage, and retrieval of information. And as we continue to warm our planet, climatology may be our only hope to save us from ourselves. During the centennial of its charter, President Kennedy addressed the Academy membership, noting, "The range and depth of scientific achievement in this room constitutes the seedbed of our nation's future. In this, the 21st century, innovations in science and technology form the primary engines of economic growth. While most remember Honest Abe for war and peace and slavery and freedom, the time has come to remember him for setting our nation on a course of scientifically enlightened governance, without which we may all perish from this earth." Thank you.
That's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. He spoke in Springfield last week. He's the latest person to be awarded the Lincoln Leadership Prize.
So that was heartfelt, and forgive me for reading it and not having memorized it, but it's an exact count of 272 words inspired by Lincoln, putting a little bit of other parts of his legacy on the map that should not go unremembered. And so I'd be delighted to field questions from the audience. If you're not near a mic, I'd be happy to repeat it with my microphone. Are there people lined up already to do this? They got people. They got people. Okay, sure, go ahead.
Hi.
Hello.
I was wondering, how close do you think we are to colonizing another planet?
How close do I think we are to colonizing another planet? See, there's a problem there, okay? When we think of colonization, we think of, for example, the Pilgrims coming over across the Atlantic from Europe to the New World. They were colonists, all right. Is that the same thing as having a ship going to Mars, let's say? No, okay? Because when the Pilgrims got off the boat with the Mayflower, they could breathe the air
okay? The trees in the New World were made out of wood, just like the trees in Europe, so they could repair their ship. There were even people on the shores greeting them. They could eat the fruit on the vines. So, if we set up habitat modules on Mars and then ship people there, is it really a colony? Or is it just a little piece of Earth on Mars? For me, a colony would be you terraform Mars. Isn't that a great word? Terraform. You seed the soils and the atmosphere, put microbes that'll generate oxygen and create an Earth on Mars. Do you realize Mars has more, though it's smaller than Earth, has more land than on Earth? And so there's plenty of places, if we overpopulate the Earth, we're going to need a place to go. That's the only, unless you figure out some other thing to do with 80 billion, I don't know what you're going to do with too many people. You're going to need extra planets. So for me, colonizing requires terraforming. And we do not yet know how to terraform. And so people, there are people who say, we need to, Stephen Hawking included, say, we need to be able to live on another planet so that we have a place to go after we trash this planet. Okay, that's not very positive thinking, but think about it. If we trash this planet, making it unlivable, and we look for another planet, we say, let's do Mars, and then we terraform Mars, turning it into Earth, okay? If we had the geoengineering power to turn Mars into Earth, we'd have the power to turn Earth back into Earth. So I don't see going to another planet as the imperative that others require of it. That word, maybe an asteroid will come make us extinct, so you want to protect the species, so have a colony on Mars. I'm thinking, okay, that makes a good headline, multi-planet species. However, I'm a practical guy, and I think to myself, whatever it takes to terraform Mars and ship a billion people there, that's probably more effort than deflecting the asteroid. That's what I'm thinking. Okay, so if we're going to go to Mars, it should be because we're exploring, and it's a fun thing to do, and there are tourist jaunts and research on life on Mars. But to do it so that we're a two-planet species in case one half goes extinct? Save everybody. So, no is my answer to you. I don't think it's happening anytime soon. Was there another question there? Do I get to go? Oh, over here, yes. Just speak loudly, and I'll, yeah, I'm looking at you. What is my thoughts on the likelihood of life on the recently discovered exoplanets? There's seven of them. Seven of them. You know, it's a little weird. Like, as I look to my left, there's like Abe Lincoln standing there. No, and he's not facing me, and I'm saying, how come he's not paying attention? And then if he actually turned around, I would scream like a baby and run the other direction. So recently announced by NASA, there's a star, a small red star. Red is, it's a cooler color than our white star, and that's even cooler than blue stars that are out there. It's a red dwarf star, we call it. Seven planets discovered, three of which are orbiting the Goldilocks zone. That's that place where temperature's just right to sustain liquid water. Too close, your water evaporates. Too far, water freezes. Just right. And life as we know it requires liquid water. So it's tantalizing to think. Well, and so we got artists to draw what the surfaces of those planets might be like, with oceans and lakes and possibly rivers. So there's some issues that were not addressed in the press. I'm just saying, okay? It turns out those planets are likely to be what's called tidally locked. When we look at the moon, it only ever shows the same face to us. There is a far side of the moon and a near side. But all sides receive sunlight, which means there is no such thing as a dark side of the moon. Thank you. In spite of what Pink Floyd told you in 1973 with their album Dark Side of the Moon, I've been taking decades to undo the damage of that rock album. So we have tidally locked the moon so that its rotation rate exactly equals the time it takes to go around us. So it is rotating, but at exactly the rate to always show the same face towards us. Okay. It turns out, if you do the math, that star will have tidally locked all of those planets. Well, if that's the case, if you're on the planet facing the sun, it's going to be too hot. And if you're on the side facing away, you'll really have a dark side. It'll be cold. So if there's civilization, they'd have to be huddled around where the boundary between light and dark is. And you'd have to like have rotisseries for people, you know, or put houses on, I don't know. But so they're Earth-sized planets, but I hesitate to call them Earth-like planets because of the rest of these issues they'd have to deal with. So not only that, red stars have ferociously turbulent surfaces. They're spewing forth high-energy particles, all solar flares, all the time. It would be deadly for us on the surfaces of those planets, simply from the radiation from the sun. So I'm sticking to Earth until we can do a little bit. Oh, and on top of that, the fastest ship we have ever built, if you aimed it for these seven planets, and I put you on that ship, okay, it would take 300,000 years to get there. Yeah, so trips to such places are incommensurate with human physiology, which means you'll just be dead long before that you get there. So we need serious warp drives and wormholes and stuff that only exist in science fiction. So that's why it's fun to think about these places, but not as a destination in anybody's lifetime.